to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So we have today Brett Solomon, who is a former campaign director at Boz.org, which is a big international grassroots online organization, and is currently working on an organization called Access Now, which is interested in activism for various kinds of digital freedom, including both sort of aggregation of data coming out and circumvention of filters, especially in Iran. And also Cameron Ashraf, who's a professor at California State University.
Adjunct. I'm applying to PhD programs right now. So
at California State, and is working on the Access Now project as well.
That's it?
Yes, that's it.
Okay. There's a microphone. Everybody can hear? Cool. All right. Okay. All right. So I'll be talking about Iran. This presentation is going to be an overview of the use of digital media inside Iran after the protests. And who of us can forget the brave men and women in June who marched all across the country for freedom of democracy? And likewise, who can forget the salient news story for us in the United States and in the West of the role of digital media in these protests? This picture, if anybody can't see it, there's a mouse at the very bottom. And Ahmadinejad is terrified of the mouse. So, but who can also forget the Iranian government's response to the use of digital media in the Iran election? This is a blog page for Twitter. Dear user, access to this site is not possible, et cetera, et cetera. The regime blocked social media sites such as Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, et cetera. Once you try to visit a site, you are greeted with this block page, which then also conveniently asks you to inform them that you were trying to visit a banned site, which is a very easy way to make a database of people who are trying to actively practice online dissent. But this digital movement inside of Iran after the elections didn't end at that block page. This is a photograph from September 18th, the Ruz-e Ghods protests that happened, and it shows that not only that the opposition itself physically hasn't been silenced, but as you can see from the outstretched hands holding cell phones up, the digital movement hasn't been silenced either. In fact, within 16 hours of these protests that you're seeing here in this photograph by Hamid Saber, over 80 videos from Iran had been smuggled out. Within 16 hours, more than 300,000 people had viewed these videos, and nearly 250,000 from inside of Iran had downloaded these videos. In a nation where news and the internet is restricted, the ability to have this media, to share this media in mobile format, and these were in 3GP format, can often be a lifeline because some people in Tehran don't know what's happening in Shiraz. Information is very segmented there. So being able to show your friends, just the protests that are happening, check this out on my cell phone, can be very powerful. We can see 250,000 people alone in September watch this. But before we can understand the role of digital media inside of Iran and inside during the protests, we should understand a little bit about Iran's internet usage. And you can see, let me point out Iran here. I do teach geography, so I know exactly where it is. But for some of you who aren't geography majors, unfortunately, let me show you where Iran is. Iran's right here. And as you can see in this map from Matt Zook at the University of Kentucky, Iran is a true standout in terms of its levels of internet penetration. This is in 2008. It has levels on par with Eastern Europe. And anyway, we'll go on to the next slide, which will explain a little bit more in terms of the numbers. 23 to 32 million people inside of Iran are estimated to use the internet. After the Islamic Revolution, there was an overwhelming fertility drive to build up a whole generation of young revolutionaries, which has also resulted in this sort of population pyramid here, where you can see the bulk of the people are young people here. So in a country that's so connected, with connectivity levels on the par with Europe, what was the regime's response at the end when the protests began? First off, there was massive traffic engineering, data transfer, massive internet traffic engineering. Data transfer was reduced by over 80%. This graph shows you that. These are the six upstream providers for Iran, and I'm going to ask you all to guess where the protests began. There, you can see it right there. And literally, quite literally, Iran virtually shut off the entire internet right away. And then traffic trickled through to be shut down again on Ruz-e Khods, to be shut down again on Sizdeh Aban, which was the protest that just recently happened, every time, and for other various events whenever they feel like it. The time to download the average regular YouTube video inside of Iran went to over an hour because of this. The regime actively and aggressively blocked opposition websites, foreign websites that would report news that wasn't party line. There was restriction on download sizes. You could only download a file of a certain size. Once you hit that size, your download was going to be cut off automatically. They monitored web traffic, and they would send and chat logs. Yahoo Messenger chat logs were used in prison as evidence against protesters. And also threatening text messages were sent. Now imagine you're sitting here, everybody has this, most of you here have a cell phone, and you receive a message like this. It calls you, first of all, respected citizen. According to received information, you have been influenced by, this is actually from just 2 weeks ago, by anti-security propaganda of foreign-backed media, translation to the BBC. If you attend any illegal gathering or contact the media, and then the photograph is cut off, unfortunately, for the rest. And so this was a threatening text message. The regime also was brilliant. Many of the official Iranian propaganda websites are actually hosted right here in the United States and Canada. Believe it or not, many of these top propaganda websites that you hear that are quoted in the newspapers being party line, many of the ones that are used inside Iran, they're actually hosted in the United States because the data, the infrastructure here is going to be a little bit more secure, a little safer, and people aren't going to look here for Iranian-hosted websites for the regime, but they're hosted here. For certain reasons, I've obviously blocked out the IP and the names of, there's a big list of sites. The regime also decided to involve itself with crowdsourcing. And one of the examples of crowdsourcing they used was a site called Gerdab, which means like whirlpool or vortex type. What Gerdab was crowdsourcing the identification of dissidents and protesters. They would use photographs from CNN, from the Western media, and also photographs that were going on to Iranian websites, Iranian blogs, etc., and then put these up and ask people to identify them. They crowdsourced it. They put rewards. When they would capture someone, they'd put a stamp over the face here on you know, one of these pictures, captured.
Was this government run?
This is government run. Yeah, this is government run. And the latest news from out of Iran in terms of the regime's response to the digital media outpouring as a result of the unrest, unprecedented in 30 years, has been the creation of a cyber police squad to swoop in, which I'm sure was already in existence, but now they're just trying to do it. Say it out there to scare people a little bit more. So the Green Movement, the regime has done all this stuff. The regime took all these steps within hours of the protests beginning. The Green Movement had to deal with opposition websites being blocked or attacked. Every major Green or opposition or reformist, even the reformist parliamentary websites were hacked or were DDoSed, were blocked or attacked. Text messaging was blocked or selectively blocked. For instance, if people were gathering in a certain square, they would shut off SMS to that square, but they would let it be in other cities. The whole point was that the whole populace didn't feel sometimes that something was going on, so one square would block SMS. No opposition members were allowed on state media, television, radio, or newspaper. Opposition newspapers had been closed, and digital communications, as I said, under increased surveillance. So this is what the Green Movement had to deal with, as you can see on this slide right here. So what was the Green Movement's response to this? How do you deal with a regime doing this stuff, especially in a country with such a high level of internet connectivity? So the dramatic graphic shows that, and it's green, the Green Movement took a Hydra-like approach to this, which was brilliant. With all the centralized information nodes blocked, hacked, or otherwise unavailable, or have, limited availability, etc., they literally became like a Hydra. As Mousavi said, you are the media, the people who are the leaders. And these weren't just empty words. These weren't just things that were said to feel good, to be a nice slogan. These were actually words that were taken as literal guidelines for the Green Movement to pursue. And this is what people did. Everybody became a leader. If this was Iran, we were all leaders. We could all take initiative to do what we could do in terms of digital media to help the movement proceed in the face of such an overwhelming response to stop it. And this is an example that came out from the Green Movement, showing that each bubble, each person, is one leaf on the tree of freedom. Here, one voice, part of the media tree of freedom. Everybody was a leader. In response to Gerdab that you saw, which was crowdsourcing the identification of protesters and dissidents, the Green Movement created Gerdab Asabs, which is the Green Whirlpool. And they used this to identify secret police. They would take photographs from people's cell phones, from media reports, put it up, and again, ask people to identify the secret police here to find them, publish their home phone numbers and addresses online. Other student leaders, this was in Mashhad just 2 weeks ago. Last week. This is in Mashhad, a very conservative religious city. What student leaders are, now each person is a leader, and that's how I'm going to refer to them as. Each student leader here in this very conservative city, very big and conservative city, put posters advertising the next upcoming protests on as the wallpapers for all the computers in the computer lab. And when it would change, they'd go back and do it again. When it would change, they'd go back and do it again. Different leaders doing different things here. Other activists online created things like stencils. They created, this is a stencil, V of the victory, V for victory. There's other stencils they've created. These stencils, once they were created online, then began to spread through Persian media, through the Persian blogs, through the blogistan, for the Persian blogosphere, and through other aspects of digital media, and actually then translated itself into offline action. People started using these to print up flyers, and then people started putting them on dollar bills. And there are probably millions of dollar bills in circulation with the V on it and with other stencils that were created. And they're just on file sharing sites. These stencils are just out there. There's no one central place they originated from, and now this is the place you get them. Someone created them, put them at multiple file sharing sites, and then they just went viral. Also, digital activists online created flyers to advertise upcoming protests. Dozens and hundreds of these extremely artistic, well thought out, and meaningful posters were created to advertise and publicize the upcoming protests and various other movements of civil unrest. For example, turning all your car lights off at night. For example, all the cars coming to the street at the same time. These ideas would originate online. Posters were created, it would spread, and the idea would continue to grow. And then the posters were printed out. This is again in Mashhad, very conservative city, and handed out, slipped under cars, slipped into doors, into mailboxes. Some very, very brave protesters would even take the protest posters that you see here and tape them on the side of police cars. So as the police would drive, you know, the cops wouldn't be paying attention too much, they would be advertising the protest inadvertently. It was brilliant. And these posters that you see here originated online. Somebody made it, some digital activist made it, put it online, it spread and went crazy, and people then started printing them and putting them out. So this is another example of leadership, of not coming from a centralized source. Like, for example, in the presidential campaign where you had, you know, a certain brand image for Barack Obama, which would then go out, everybody was their own brand manager, if you want to do it that way. So quite literally, the response was, we are all leaders. And this is why it was Hydra-like. It's really difficult to quantify or explain the Green Movement digital response, as I'm sure you can gather. All the main opposition sites inside of Iran for the Green Movement are independent and stand alone. Everybody depends on them, yet nobody depends on any one of them, if that concept makes sense. Blogs, whole blogs would be created to get one message out and then shut down. Twitter accounts would come out and just repeat the same message, shut down. Facebook groups come out just to put one theme, you know, protest posters for this square in this city. And that's it. And then shut down. Just like a hider, you chop off one head, something else would come up. Something else would keep coming up constantly because the country is so connected. Each person is a leader. Each person became an information node digitally. Yet at the same time, each person was part of a larger movement. The Green Movement's response, basically, has been to create a digital movement whose leader is itself, whose central organizing structure is viral with ebbs and flows that adapts to the constantly changing and shifting digital and social landscape in post-election Iran. So we don't just have the regime. We don't just have the Green Movement. We also, as many of you are familiar with, we had a tremendous outpouring of international support for the Green Movement due to the extreme actions that were taken by the regime that were, first of all, brutal to watch. Second of all, many people could identify with internet censorship, shutting off the internet, things like that. Internet activists joined together to help Iranians circumvent censorship, circumvent filtering that was going on. You saw the traffic restrictions. CNN fail was created, the hashtag on Twitter, to force CNN to sort of pay attention to what was going on, to find, you know, to wake up and look at this stuff. Media also had difficulty getting news information out of Iran and started to rely on sources like Twitter and other groups, not just Twitter. One of the first things international activists did was right away was DDoS, was distributed denial of service attacks against main opposition, main regime websites, excuse me, Khamenei's site, Ahmadinejad's site, and various other president.ir, the whole load. This is actually there's a delicious group, a delicious list created that spread a lot, showing you click on these links and you would take it to your site that you would automatically start DDoSing websites. And so what this had the unintended effect of doing was actually slowing down already slow traffic in Iran, making it even slower. So this was an example when people were well-intentioned, but a sort of group help think mentality came about, which ended up hurting people ultimately. With what limited access they had was slowed down further. And here, example, was when you try to go to Ahmadinejad's site, it shut down. It was blocked. It went down. They also created proxies. This is a map showing you 87 countries worldwide that created several thousand proxies to support the Iranians. And you can see the most populous were the United States, Brazil, and China. But if you think about it, it's about 2,000 to 3,000 proxies were used to create this map. And in a country of 70 million with about 23 to 32 million people online, it's a drop in the bucket, even if you count for the multiplier effect, because Iranian culture is a very sharing culture. Everybody comes around, take a look, you know, look at this. Even if you account for that, it's a drop in the bucket. And so there needed to be, imagine, I just couldn't help thinking when this was happening, what if there was like a bigger thing going on, like more, you know, more attention coming toward this. And one of the problems with this, with activists coming together to do this, was the cultural gap. And this is something that's lost, I think, a lot in the internet, is the conception there is another culture. We're all digital, you know, it doesn't seem like there is, but there is. Many people came in and they started thinking, you know, this is going to be a revolution on American time. It's going to be done in 1 week. We're done, finished, new government. And I would try to tell people, you know, we're talking to friends about what's going on. You know, this is going to be Iranian. We're going to be very slow. Take our time. Relax. It's going to take a long time. It's going to be on Iranian time. This is not going to be an American time revolution. And so people who are providing proxy servers, what have you, digital activists, they get bored. Michael Jackson died, and quite literally, it was like night and day in terms of the help, the attention for Iran, the help for Iran. Like Reza Aslan said, he's an Iranian journalist, he said, when the U.S. media doesn't pay attention in Iran, people die because they feel they can get away with it. And that the joke that went around was that Ahmadinejad killed Michael Jackson because it was, and quite honestly, it was probably the best thing that could have happened to help the regime out, the media coverage. So this happens, people get bored, it's moving too slow, it's not happening on American time for them, it's just taking a very, very slow pace, and so people lose bored, and so you don't have a reliable set of people, a reliable set of digital activists actually helping out. You have fickle activism, in a sense. Popularity-based activism. When it's trendy, it's cool, let's do it. The international response continued, but we also provided, in the international sense, we the world, safe avenue for photos, videos, documents, etc., hosting these important bits of media that were coming out. In fact, just at the September 18th protests I mentioned, 300,000 people watched videos, 250,000 downloaded them from inside of Iran. And these files themselves were then spread. This is another example of the decentralized Hydra-like network. These files and the people would download would spread. People would create new download hubs, essentially cloning the original download hub. So as you would shut down one, let's say Iranian agents would go onto YouTube and vote videos down, call them violent or whatever, and they would be removed, and they'd do other sorts of things too. And then you would have other replicants of these download nodes so that files could continually be available to the opposition without being shut down. And then these, the location of these files were spread throughout the Persian blogosphere, popular Persian websites. Like I said, people would create a blog and say, hey, heads up, this is where it's at, blog would be down in 10 hours. Just be up just to get enough people, and then it would spread. So I haven't even talked about Twitter, but that was what I kept reading about here in the West when this stuff was going. I read more about Twitter than I read about what was going on in Iran during millions of people pouring out in the street, which was a little bit interesting. And quite frankly, personally, I believe the role of Twitter was grossly overstated by many. There was a lot of critical media about it, well, which I was very happy to see. But I think it was really grossly overstated calling it the Twitter revolution. I believe the actual Twitter revolution was in the United States for this. So that people could see that they could make a difference. When you even would change your avatar green on Twitter, people really cared in Iran. It really did make a difference because they didn't feel alone. Because you're bombarded, you know, all of a sudden, one minute you're the cause celebre on the news, the next minute Michael Jackson's dead and you're gone and your friends are being killed or tortured,
and then seeing that there's still people out there with their Twitter avatar green, people would feel supported. And so I think that's where the Twitter revolution was here, in my opinion. Anyway, so this is the example of the cartoons that went around talking about Twitter was doing all this stuff, stopping repression, stopping violence, as an example there. But Twitter had some important sources. In fact, I'm sure many of you maybe have heard of the torture allegations that came out of even prison and things like that. And actually the first accounts of torture inside of Iran as connected to the protest, the previous torture allegations, came through Twitter, which then went to CNN, went to the media, went to Amnesty International. And I'm going to show you some of these tweets. Very few people have seen these here. And I'll read those and then... Every claim that came through these direct messages on Twitter was proven, has been proven true and actually acknowledged by members of the regime. These are direct messages. No, these are, excuse me? Oh, of course they do. Of course they do. But people get released, people get out, people bribe guards. Yeah, exactly. They release, it's part of the propaganda machine. People get out, so it doesn't look like it's so repressive. It's part of the image. Oh, these guys are out. It's not so bad. These other guys must be really bad. They released some of them. You know, do you see what I'm trying to say? It's part of an image. Twitter actually also did become a news source for sites like CNN. You can see right here. The CNN refers to Persian Kiwi on Twitter as a source. Unattributed, not saying, didn't say it was from Twitter. They just called it a source. So, of course, you know, assuming journalistic standards, you start to, oh, wow, you know, they were direct on the phone with somebody, but then you look for the same text on Twitter, and you're like, wait a minute, this guy just cut and pasted. I can cut and paste and get, but I don't get paid that much to cut and paste. Anyway, and illustrating this concept of the media kind of dropping the ball and the role that Twitter and electronic media played, this is a photograph from a demonstration on July 17th. Up to 24 hours afterwards, Reuters was telling us that there were several dozen protesters at the same time as this photo was released. Several dozen, two dozen, a couple of weeks, about the size of this room was there. Contrasted with other agencies like CNN, which you saw, which did use Twitter, they were able to report, you know what, there's a ton of people in the streets right now, not a few dozen. Other news sources that decided to use citizen media like this were able to have paint an accurate picture of what was happening. I'm sorry. As you can see here, what happened was several dozen protesters was the regime's line. So you had mainstream media. Not only are we in the United States hosting websites that feed the propaganda machine for the regime, but mainstream media would just quote the regime literally from PressTV.ir and put that as the news story saying several dozen protesters are there. So in the absence of believing citizen media, you believe propaganda. That doesn't seem like a fair trade-off to me. So some Twitter takeaway points, however. I'm not totally down on Twitter. I think there are some very good things, some very, very useful things. According to the Web Ecology Project, gentlemen, between June 7th and June 26, 2009, there were over 2 million tweets about the election in Iran, with about 500,000 users taking part in this conversation. So what are the takeaway points from this incredible outpouring of discussion on Twitter? First of all, I believe it was a stunning mechanism that brought the attention of Iran to the world. I think some people now in America know where Iran is, that it's not next to Germany, that it's, you know, Middle East. It really highlighted the media's lack of legitimate sources in Iran and the power of citizen media. Basically, when you have mainstream media sources just aping regime propaganda, they become part of the propaganda machine. So, as I see it, so Reuters became part of the regime's propaganda machine by just copying and pasting these things. So because they had no sources and they weren't willing to trust the sources that were there. Not that I know of. There were few, but then they developed it, but in the first days, as far as I know, no. Then it developed.
They were there for the election, but they were kicked out.
You couldn't go out of your hotel room.
BBC was arrested and kicked out.
You couldn't leave your hotel room if you wanted to stay.
Yeah, they weren't allowed to go into the streets.
The Guardian actually was amazing because they were doing the best job. They had people out in the street filming with cell phones. Even like the media guys, press guys in The Guardian would just go out with their own cell phones to film on their own personal phones to get some of these stories out. And you would see, contrast it with CNN and other news. I'm not trying to get down on CNN. They did an amazing job. An amazing job. But other news people just sat in the room and obeyed the regime. These guys went out. It was remarkable. It brought one of the most important things, I think, really, from the takeaway from Twitter and all this, was that it brought digital activists together who didn't know each other, but who had a common interest in Iran and human rights and freedom of information, and who had contacts in Iran. It brought them together to form teams and bonds that are incredibly strong. But it also brought them attention of the media, so that you could get in direct contact with people at CNN and say, hey, heads up, I've got this stuff for you. This is one of the most important takeaway points. And I believe because of seeing that, it has massive potential, sort of a digital media, journalism, and activism commons. And 480,000 users, 2 million tweets, after all the research that I've done and talking to many of the biggest of the biggest Twitter accounts for Iran election, I would estimate there's no more than 12 to 50 of the actual users of the 480,000 people, only 12 to 50 were actually inside Iran itself. Now, that doesn't mean that there wasn't a lot of news coming out from Iran from other people in the Iranian diaspora who were talking to their friends online, calling people, and then posting it. I'm talking about people directly inside of Iran actually doing it. So the numbers, just because you have a lot of noise, doesn't mean you have a lot of signal in terms of what's coming out. Anyway, conclusion. You all can read that, and I'll talk about the last point. The digital media situation right now, I think, is more intense than at any point since June, because of the lack of media coverage, because of people getting bored and losing interest. To give you an idea, the November 4th protests just were a few weeks ago. The videos that came out, within 48 hours, there's 250,000 downloads, and within 72 hours, there's 350,000 downloads. That's about 52, from inside of Iran, that's about 5,200 downloads per hour and 87 downloads per minute from inside Iran on a story that the media people aren't talking about. And so digital media continues to play an important role in a country that's disconnected. I think that's it.
Maybe I'll just speak for a little bit, just for a couple of minutes, just to kind of perhaps put this into a broader perspective. I have been working at avaz.org, which is a global movement of 3.5 million people, and we've run some digital rights campaigns over the last year or so that have been, I think, quite effective within Burma, in Tibet, and most recently within Iran, and which is how actually this team kind of formed. Interestingly, we worked out yesterday that we actually all met on Twitter, which is kind of another point that you should add to the...
Met Brett.
But we do think that there is potential to kind of take some of the lessons that have been learned from Iran, plus also a number of the other, many other countries that we know, perhaps somewhere around 80 to 100, there's evidence of censorship or surveillance online. And we think that, there's a real potential here to build a global movement around digital freedom. I guess that's kind of my background, is building movements. I also used to be the executive director of GetUp, which is the Australian version of MoveOn, which very quickly became perhaps the most powerful non-union, non-party political force in the country in the space of, 18 months or so. And so we're going to give it a bit of a go to see whether we can kind of build a movement of people around the world, perhaps linked by some sort of proxy cloud, that can influence decisions. We know that there's everything from bits of legislation that are before the Senate in Australia to, hardcore blocking and censorship and propaganda and surveillance in Iran and everywhere in between, if we look at, Tunisia and Uzbekistan and Tibet and et cetera. But we also think that there's potential to have like a cyber relief team. I mean, in a sense, that's what the whole kind of Iran Access group has been, as a cyber relief team that's come at a moment of crisis to prise open the internet. And we know that those moments are going to continue to happen across the world. But we also know that those moments, when those moments are going to happen. So, for instance, you know, with Russia and Georgia, we know that in anticipation we can provide that kind of capacity. We also think that there's that, you know, there's this kind of linkage point between what's happening on the ground and the international media. And I think many of us here have kind of contributed to that process to be able to draw out what's happening on the ground, whether it be, you know, bloggers who have been imprisoned or BBC Persia that's been shut down or whatever it might be, or instances of abuse within prisons. But we hope to be able to kind of extract some of that stuff on the ground to replicate what's happened here in Iran, to learn the lessons from other countries and kind of cross-pollinate. So there's some other bits and pieces to our plan, and there's sort of a start-up, I guess. We think that there's lots of potential there. We'd like to work with people. We know that there's many organisations in the field, like you know, ONI and Global Voices and so on, have done tremendous work, and of course the Berkman Centre. So we sort of see ourselves as joining the movement in a particularly tense time now, when governments are learning from each other, and how to censor, how to block, how to monitor, and how to use the internet as a way in which to maintain the status quo. You know, we've seen that governments have, we know that governments now know that they can be formed and topple online, and so we want to be part of this sort of civil society response to that. So that's kind of my bit. Maybe we can now open up to questions. And
anybody have any questions?
Questions?
I was interested in how you were able to calculate the so-called shutting down of the internet. Many of the internet service providers have direct connections to the internet gateway in Vienna and other parts of Europe, so they're not going through a national gateway. So I'm very interested how you get the data
to
show that. But the other thing is, would it not be possible? I mean, I can appreciate that they would have other ways to, you know, they've set you on a license, you know, either you shut down, you know, the bandwidth, or, you know, we're going to renege your license renewal, and the government will shut down private providers. But I was just wondering whether, given all the traffic on YouTube and all the, you know, SMSing and so on, and calling, everybody was calling to try to get information. What's going on? What have you heard? It's just that, you know, it's the way of life anyway. Wouldn't that be enough to have slowed it down as much as it did?
So you have two questions.
Yeah, well, the first, really three. You know, did the government, what evidence, what real evidence did you have that the government acted? Perhaps it could have just been this massive amount of traffic anyway. Uploading, downloading, calling, you know, it was, everybody was always on some device trying to get information or give information.
Well, you have actually used statements from the regime itself. Saying that, you know, they're trying to control the internet. Text messages were sent to people that the internet is under maintenance. Right at that time, text messages were sent to people. So, and messages were, email messages, phone messages were left. The internet is going to be under maintenance, you know, just happens to be for the duration of unrest, you know, that kind of stuff. So they basically would say yes. The graph itself is from Arbor Networks. It wasn't compiled from our own data or anything. But that was the regime. The regime was basically saying that we're doing this.
And Arbor Networks?
Arbor Networks is where we got the graph, just to illustrate the concept of how they literally shut down the internet. And they've done it every time. You get also firsthand accounts as soon as the November 4th protests that just happened, right at the meeting time when Caribbean was supposed to come out. Mysteriously, total chance, internet was under maintenance again. Total chance.
It was just actually a little bit interesting. Arbor Networks is a company that makes DDoS detection equipment, and something like 70% of the ISPs in the world run their equipment, and then it reports aggregate data back to Arbor. So Arbor is one of the larger sort of large-scale surveillers of the internet. They have a very good big-scale view of the kind of traffic that's flowing.
I mean, I can appreciate the traffic going down. It's just, you know, what caused it. But I know they can block certain sites, you know, but
I guess I'm wondering if what you can sort of say about what should happen now, because I think, as you rightly noted, the media attention moved on to Michael Jackson and other things, and especially in the U.S., there isn't much attention on this thing. And I also thought maybe you could attach it to what happened in Burma. It's interesting, in Burma, like in the 80s, that there were a lot of, sort of before the internet, a lot of groups formed, and then mostly ecologists, and then that they sort of were able to push legislative changes that occurred and actually got sanctions to happen against Burma in the end. So I'm wondering if you sort of have ideas about what should be done now, both by people in the U.S., but as well as around the world.
Like, what can be done in what respect, though, like technology-wise or activism-wise?
Maybe more activism-wise.
Well, you know, we all know that, I'm sure many of you might know, you know, Nokia sold a lot of the surveillance equipment to Iran. I mean, I know they issue press releases constantly, you know, saying we didn't do it. But even in Iran, there's Nokia billboards, like in Shiraz, and they'll take green paint and they'll splatter it all across the billboard. Just to, you know, kind of bring the point home. I think there needs to be, quite frankly, I know we've moved away now in the past few months from a dialogue on human rights in an effort to negotiate on nuclear things, but any sort of negotiation a lot of Iranian culture will imply acceptance of, legitimacy of. You know what I mean? And so I think in terms of activism, if people want to get involved, they need to say, we need to keep human rights on the table in addition to the nuclear issue, not one or the other. I think that's the biggest, in my personal opinion.
I think one of the interesting things that we saw with 13 of Ban, which was the protests that happened, coincided with the 30th anniversary of the student takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, was that, you know, we saw these massive numbers, and yet trying to get the international media focused on it was just very difficult. I mean, there was another side of the story, but the story from the kind of the Green Movement's perspective was that they were using that as an opportunity to actually get out on the streets on a day where it's, you know, sort of encouraged to do so. And part of the discussion was, you know, it was kind of like "Death to America" is the chant, and there was this kind of subtle move to, which we talked about, was like, you know, death to no one, and there was a really interesting kind of thread that started to then go online and then onto the streets of like death to no one as a slogan for the street protest. But I mean, one of the things that also happened that I think was interesting was this kind of development of like a dashboard, which brought together a lot of the social media, including, you know, YouTube, which had protest videos that were uploaded very quickly, Twitter, which had Iran hashtag Iran election and various others as well coming through, a Google map, which showed where the protests were taking place so that you could actually see that it wasn't just individual protests. Live blogs so that people could anonymously comment. So you have like one central spot where the Green Movement was able to kind of, and it was built in coordination with people around the world. So it's like one central spot where you could kind of see the international media, could see what was happening, they could see that this wasn't just isolated events, and that the movement itself could also have a central hub and point where it could kind of coordinate and mobilize and so on.
Can I add to this, Brett? Yeah. The other thing, too, is I think we have to keep in mind that the diaspora, in spite of the lack of international attention or just general media attention, there's still a lot of momentum within the community. And they regularly, like, you know, talk with their friends and families within Iran. The problem is there's still a lot of, there's a lack of information or a centralized hub for real-time information on safe internet practices. The regime is constantly adapting its techniques to, you know, censor and filter the internet. And some of these, you know, they'll develop these, like, you know, surveillance techniques on the spot. For example, during the 13 Aban protest, they left YouTube.com up. And there were some tweeters who were advising people not to upload videos in the fear that that information be used against them in retrospect. So that's one field where I feel that digital activists, I think, or we as an organization feel that activism can really help contribute.
Just along the lines of that question, then, in the sense that the media has sort of moved moved on? My question is, have the Iranians moved on? And I ask because I mean, having lived in the Middle East for most of my life, Arabs and people in the Middle East have a very short-term memory. I mean, 2005, when you know, Hariri was assassinated in Lebanon, 1.5 million in the streets, Palestine, Egypt, momentum. A year later, Condoleezza Rice says these are the birth pangs of a new Middle East. It hasn't happened. And my question is, has the moment passed for Iran?
First of all, my experience as Iranian is that Iranians have the longest memory that I've ever known. When I was little, my dad, who maybe is watching, would tell me how he hated Alexander the Great still. With the kind of intensity, like, you would hate someone, like, who's sitting next to you. You know, and Genghis Khan, don't even talk about Mongolian people. That was off limits. So the memory, maybe in other parts is different, but for Iran, the memory is, like, it's way too long. It's etched in stone, you know? And as regards to the moment passing, I personally, and just from all the things that we know, I think it is intensifying beyond belief. Resistance has moved from being something you went out and did, if this makes sense. You go out, you protest, you come home, live your life. Resistance has become part of the culture. And this is a fundamental shift, because green has become part of a way of life now. And that's the main difference you're seeing. You're not seeing, like, oh, let's go protest back home.
Yeah.
Let's go protest and let's go home and figure out what we can do to resist. Little stupid things. People, they'll drive, they'll go along and they'll just, with a green marker, just put a V for victory somewhere. These little things, it's become, when resistance becomes part of a culture, I think you've entered a whole new phase. And that's what's happening. That's what we're seeing right now, is just the concept of resisting this regime has become just part of a way of life. And that's very hard to, it's easy to stop protests, it's hard to stop a way of life. Yes, sir.
So there's a very interesting progression from, you think about civil rights protesters in the United States, you need a battery of lawyers to come in and protect them so they could do their protests. Now we have a battery of technologists who need to come in and provide the backup here. But if the ultimate strategic success is going to depend upon keeping the attention or leveraging attention or figuring out how to play with that attention, it sounds like there almost needs to be a third layer of support here, which is kind of publicist-like perspective. Like, what is it that you need to be doing to advise a revolution or people fighting a revolution about how to frame or how to push the message so that, you know, the attention span of the American public, which is 0.6 seconds, can be directed in the most effective way? Or is that...
But I'm not sure. I mean, I think that this the focus on the international media is actually somewhat overplayed, because internally within... Yeah. Iran, I mean, there's kind of two things happening here. One is that there's a, you know, sort of a revolution on the streets, but there's also an extraordinary power play that's happening amongst the elite within Iran. And I think that actually my perspective on it is that the sort of the outcome will play out internally rather than because there's been international pressure or international media exposure.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think events are moving in such a way that the movement is leading itself, like I talked about earlier. It's just going down its direction. I think the international attention helps, especially in Iran. They're very sensitive to international media. I think it helps the movement. That's one of the reasons they try to get so many things out there, so that people, you know, hey, we're here. We're not all terrorists, you know. It's okay. Some of us are good. I think it would help, but I think in this case, it's not necessarily something that's crucial to the movement's success.
Well, I don't know about the crucial, you know, how important is a separate question, but it does sound like, from what you were talking about, being able to keep attention was an essential part to saving people's lives.
It is important in Iran.
So then there's a question of, like, how do you help people frame what they're doing in a way that keeps attention?
Yeah.
Like, some sort of things will be successful, others won't, just like some sort of technological responses to the repression will be successful and others won't.
Mm.
And it seems like if you think about the array of service necessary to leverage this most effectively, this is going to be part of it, right?
Yeah. No, that's a really interesting concept, like a publicist, a PR manager.
I mean, I think that the lesson, I think, is that, you know, if you look at some of the images and the kind of framing that's emerged out of the street, that the PR lessons actually are coming that way. I mean, we're learning as well about how to frame. And you know, if you can, maybe if you can combine those two things together, so you can kind of have the street framing and the street imagery and the kind of organic, chaotic nature of what comes out of being a repressed people, added to, I mean, we know, for instance, that it's not just about PR. There is also like extraordinary amount of lobbying that's going on the Hill, for instance, to look at, to, you know, because we've got this whole nuclear issue as well, obviously wrapped up in this. So, I mean, I think that, you know, sort of a sort of concerted lobbying approach in Washington is probably a good one. And I think that the other element of it as well, and this is one of the things that Avaaz is doing, of course, is like a citizens movement as well, like a global citizens movement that's trying to, like, if you looked at the Washington Post editorial the other day around, you know, get ready to bomb Iran, like, how does there be a sensible, sane, human citizens movement that's able also to engage with this whole process?
That same thread, I'm certainly very sympathetic to the value of PR there, but I wonder whether in some cases it might be counterproductive, and that there's a certain authenticity with internet communications and with protest movements. Mm. And yeah. I'm not sure how you merge the two of them effectively. I guess I don't know of any good examples out there. I've seen a lot of ham-handed attempts at online PR, and it usually, you know, it's the Pepsi Blue thing. It kind of comes flying back again. And I don't know if there are really good examples of doing that.
Yeah, I guess if you think about PR in a kind of 20th century conception of PR, I would agree with you, but I don't really mean that. What I mean is, it's almost, there's a technical question about how do you best connect with what we know is an ongoing media outside of a particular country. How do you do it in an effective way? Just like, how do you connect to a cloud in a way that's going to protect the integrity of the material inside it? That's a technical question too. And how do you connect with lawyers who are actually going to be able to go in and protect you in places where you can be protected? These are all dimensions of the problem. And if the fickleness, my only point is, if the fickleness of at least the United States attention is costly, then figuring out how to play that game well would be a very high return investment.
Is that equivalent to the Michael Jackson problem, in that we're trying to educate media consumers to pay attention to things that are more important? Kind of the,
well, I think it might be
broccoli.
About just recognizing the Michael Jackson problem and figuring out what do you do in light of the Michael Jackson problem. I mean, like, you know, given you're facing a media that's going to, you know, you're sitting in Iran, you're running your revolution, you're trying to figure out how to fight back against the government. You need to be aware of the fact that when Michael Jackson of the world dies, they're going to disappear. What do you do to respond to that? How do you counter that? Like, what is the thing to minimize the cost of that attention span?
I would push back a little bit about the media framing as well, because as far as I know, I have data that shows that this sort of move of Jackson and Iran and the media that this, but as far as I know, the same thing happened on Twitter, right?
Oh yeah.
So, and I would, as far as we're thinking about outreach, I think that is maybe a more useful way to think about this problem, is how do you keep interest on Twitter, which is notoriously sort of like the mainstream media, very sort of instantaneous.
Yeah. I mean, back to the global citizens movement, I do think that kind of lessons from Avaaz have been that, like, one of the things about online organizing is that, you know, in previous kind of, which differs to previous protests before, is that you'd sort of have to, in response to a moment, you had to build a movement to kind of respond, and then after the moment died away, the movement would, you know, the sort of collection of people or the energy would die away. With online organizing, when you've got this mass number of people, it's kind of like a standing army that then can be continuously in place and grow, and kind of, it obviously surges at moments, but it can kind of respond to different issues as they arise. And the kind of maturity and the kind of the response of the movement actually grows over time as well.
Along the question about framing and the movement, I'm curious about how the student leaders see themselves in terms of being digital organizers versus being, you know, multimedia organizers and multi-event organizers. I think it was only in the last few months on some campaign email list I'm a member of, that I was actually told, take this text and tweet it. You know, that it was such a very specific instruction within that that sphere of online activism. And I'm just wondering, you know, do they tend to use that sort of language and see, okay, your domain here is, you know, this social media sphere of activism, or is it, well, maybe we'll do Twitter, but I'm also going to go out and do this in the streets, and I'm going to talk to my grandparents and all these dimensions.
It's all everything. It's everything. The movement is comprehensive. I mean, if you look at the protests, you see videos. One of the most touching videos, at least I saw, was an Iran-Iraq war veteran, old guy walking through the streets protesting. You know, so you see, it's people who don't have internet, people who have internet. It's everything. It's part of the whole recipe, part of the stew.
But in terms of the organizers, like, is there a division of labor?
I would say it's quite haphazard and quite organic. There have been some people who have been leaders since beforehand, you know. I mean, this was in response to an election, and there were student leaders involved in that, and they continue to be involved. But there were people who came on the scene after they felt that their vote was stolen, and they've kind of, like, you know, done things their own way on various social media sites. And I think now, in a sense, it is a matter of connecting these people if they want to be connected, because this is very much a movement driven by the people, and that's one of the things we really believe, that, you know, we should be enabling the people as activists instead of telling them what they want.
I'd like to ask you perhaps an unfair question, and if you can't answer, just say so, but you've certainly been paying a lot more attention to Iran than most of us in this room, and through the 30 years of living in this country, when I question, you know, why didn't you come and free me, or any other country that was happening, most of the U.S. officials usually answer, well, it has to be a movement from within the country, and it has to be from the people, and it has to come from the citizens of its own country. About Iran right now, besides Obama being completely silent and not saying anything at all, what is the administration as far as helping Iranians' position at all, besides complete silence? Because I haven't seen anything at all.
I haven't. I haven't seen. I mean, they cut the funding for the human rights org. I mean, the protest on November 4th, one of the main chants was Obama, Obama, Yabu Una, Yabu Ma. Obama, Obama, with them, Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, or with us. That is how much it's gotten into the culture now, that the movement even says, either Obama, you're with them or with us. What are you doing? And I think that's reflective of the response, exactly, that I haven't seen very much.
Honestly. Have you seen anything at all besides complete silence and ignoration?
From the Republican Party, there's been talk.
No.
From the administration, nothing.
Yeah,
we want to go shake his hand.
I think our position is this administration is definitely hedging its bets on. They're trying to play both sides, but they've been more clearly on public front. They've legitimized the regime, and they haven't really done much to legitimize the green movement. They don't really acknowledge it.
But with all fairness, yeah, I mean, we don't know that much about the ability of the American regime to actually have an impact in Tehran and the impact of what they're going to do. We've seen it go both ways through history, and this is a really cloudy area. We've been yelling at Castro for decades in Cuba, and it's done nothing. And I think to say that the U.S. government should take a clear stance on this, I think is convenient in many ways, but whether that's going to have the impact that most of us would like to see for a greater opening there, that's very unclear, I think.
And I think that the silence in its own weird way has been empowering, because now many of the people seem to feel we can do it. We can do it now. We don't have to rely on Russia. We don't have to rely on the U.S. to come. You know, it's coming from within. You know what I'm trying to say?
But I think also that, you know, sort of many of the proposals that are on the table for the U.S. response to the regime are actually potentially very disempowering for the Green Movement as well. So, for instance, the introduction of gasoline sanctions has even, you know, been said by Mousavi and many of the Green Movement that is actually going to put us in a weaker position, because we're going to either have to come out, I mean, for a number of reasons, but, you know, one reason being that they will have to come out and denounce the US and denounce the West in the same way, or be seen to be part of it, be seen to be part of the Great White Satan. And I think that, you know, we need to, I mean, the administration, whilst it has been, you know, relatively silent. I think that it also, you know, there is a sort of a time process. I mean, there is a sort of time frame that's been established. I think there's a whole nuclear issue here that is, you know, is of major concern internationally for all of us. So it's not just, I think, a simple question of the administration's been silent, which I don't think it has been. But I think that this is a very complex.
You don't think it has been?
I don't think it's been. I mean, I think there has been certainly some sort of sacrifice that's happened in terms of, you know, nuclear human rights, you know, sort of democracy. I think that's definitely been the case. But, you know, we know that there's significant negotiations and discussions that are happening through different channels in order to come to some kind of step forward from a decade-long standoff.
But with all due respect to both of you, you know, at the time of Jackson Pollock Amendment, there was also nuclear issues and things like that. And yet that was the first opening of a small part of a window. And yes, dictatorships are different, but they all have a lot of similarities. And just from the personal experience,
yeah.
I remember as a child, Jackson Pollock's amendment passing in US Congress and making a difference.
Mm. I guess the question is, what is the appropriate course of action? Like
certainly would seem to be not appropriate. Some kind of an action.
I saw you first.
Yeah, it's just a brief question. What hope do you have that the regime will change, that the resistance will have the effect?
Honestly, I think it's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
I think it's going to happen. Like I said, it's become part of the culture. It's just become, now for the first time, people woken up, were like, hey, heads up, this is a total dictatorship. Like all the fake, he's just a fatherly guide telling us spiritually what to do. It's been exposed. That's my feeling.
So then what?
Then what?
Who knows in a country like Iran? Yeah. Who knows? You know, hopefully, they'll go toward, you know, a more democratic, you know, abolishing the position of the supreme leader into a U.S. or, you know, European type of democracy model. That's what I feel. I mean, who knows? You know, but I think they will succeed. That's my deep, deep feeling.
Yeah, and I mean, it looks quiet, I think, from our end, looking, you know, from the outside looking in, but this was kind of like the same thing that happened the last time there was a revolution. The Ayatollah was able to tap into a lot of latent energy, a lot of latent resentment in the population. I think this is what this movement's doing. It's grabbed that latent energy, and it's just a matter of time and just galvanizing and, you know, just the appropriate time frame.
You need a sense of what it's longing for.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than what it's just against. That's obvious. What it's longing for is
democracy.
Right? Yeah.
Like democracy and, you know, not being told what to do and not being having a religion forced upon you that you have to follow if you don't choose to follow. I think the same basic values, you know, most of us here hold. I think that's really what they're...
But it is also interesting to reflect that the Green Movement is actually brings together the monarchists and the communists.
All spectrum.
You know, so in terms of trying to find and identifying what for, I think you're right. It's much more difficult because what actually unites the Green Movements is actually what they're against.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you were next. I'm sorry.
I was just wondering, you know, it seems like it would be very easy for the government to try and infiltrate these movements if anybody can be a leader. Has that been happening? Has that been a problem? How do they deal with that?
For sure they've been infiltrating. They post stuff, you know, saying they would do a lot of disinformation stuff, like, okay, we're going to meet at this square, and then, but they would say, oh, no, it's actually going to be here, it's going to be at this time. They would do that stuff, but eventually, because the movement is so decentralized and so organic, and just like this massive, for lack of a better term, a blob that moves and knows what direction it's moving, when you've got one part of your blob moving in a totally different direction, eventually the movement catches up. It's like a self-healing network. Like, hey, this is kind of weird, you know, so let's forget this guy and go this way. You know what I'm trying to say? This is what we've observed. Is these kind of weird voices that try to infiltrate? It's so obvious to many of them, like they don't buy it. For 30 years, they've learned how to not buy these kind of people who try to infiltrate everything, and so they're pretty good at it right now. That's from what I've seen.
You referred briefly to the sort of maneuvering between different clerics and leaders within the Iranian government. I was wondering if you could say anything about what kind of interaction there's been between what's going on in the streets and what's going on within the government. The people within the government.
Yeah, because there's moderate
moderate clerics and the more extreme right-wing clerics and the more reformist-minded clerics. And basically, quite literally, people on the street are political capital. They're all products of the revolution, so they all remember the same scenes. If you look, there's been tons of photo montages done showing the same streets in 1979, 1978, and today, same size of crowds. And it's just political capital. Literally, in one of the speeches that Rafsanjani gave, he called for people to come out and then proceeded to, at his speech when there was lots of people, use more harsh language. And that at other times when there was less people, the language was toned down. So if you do these kind of micro-analysis, because Iranian politics is very nuanced, you can see these kind of little things going on. These people are just political capital for, in the minds of the mullahs, their political capital is these people on the street, that they can force concessions. They can try to force concessions. And so that's what is moving a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff, because people say now, look, Khamenei, look, you know, nobody likes you. No, Ahmadinejad, nobody likes, you know what I mean? The stuff, if you want to survive, I mean, that's part of it, you know.
What you said, it sounds really encouraging, but what is the state of the urban liberals being balanced out by the rural conservatives, as we've been led to believe?
Oh, yeah, okay. There's a really good question. There was Ahmadinejad went to Tabriz just Friday. State media put this beautiful picture. Yeah, you know, it's about the northwest of the country. It's a little bit more, you know, it's still a big city. Crowds everywhere. But then another government photographer showed there was maybe 100 people. A lot of it is propaganda. A lot of it is like, oh, they all support Ahmadinejad. Well, the prices, the inflation is high for everybody there. The jobless rate is high for everybody there. It doesn't just affect the cities. So I think he has a lot of support, not only support there, he has a lot of support in the it's not a lot, but supports in the urban areas. But what you see is when you see the amount of people that come out for his things, this is their chance to, you know, to really do something, it shows a lot. Think about it, 170 million people, 15 million of them live in one city. That's the power of the urban environment in Iran. I think he has a lot of support out there, but also one interesting thing that happened in the Ruz al-Quds protest was they bust in the Basiji people, the religious militia, they bust them in. And they're getting younger and younger now. They're busting in like 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, because a lot of them they're getting harassed. The families are leaving them, saying, "Why are you beating our people?" Stuff like that. So they're having to go younger and younger. You know, like kind of dropping the draft age, right? And when people wisen up, they don't want to be part of this anymore. So they're getting younger and younger people. And then these kids are coming in, and for the first time, it's having an opposite effect when they bring the Basiji in. And they're being exposed now to the first time for the ideas behind the Green Movement. They're like, "Wait a minute, so." You mean he's not really, like, the president doesn't have any power? You know what I mean? Like, ideas they never heard of before. Yeah. And it goes out into the rural areas. And you're seeing, within the past 2 months, a lot of rural activity, a lot of rural protests. Some of the first videos from the Ruz al-Quds, which was in September, and in the Siz de Aban, which was in November, some of the first videos to come out were rural area videos, not urban, for the first time in this movement. And that's significant, I think. Yes, sir.
So we could, without, say, getting the United States government to make some kind of prognosis. We as a people who feel very sympathetic with the Iranians who are in this movement, are there specific things that we can do to just echo the fact that they are doing these things, as you say, that isn't, I mean, act as the media, essentially, within the United States to help create the awareness?
Human rights, personally, human rights issues. You know, write your congresspeople. I mean, they pay attention when you write these people and fax them. They actually will get back to you. You know, you actually request meetings, at least with staffers, and then it's feed. I mean, it's not everybody says all that stuff, but it really does. It's crazy because it does work. Like, they're like, "Oh, you're right, huh?" And when they see, like, a lot of these guys don't see the videos, and then when they see a video of someone being shot just because they just don't agree with something, not they want to overthrow, but they don't agree it, you know, and it's like, wait a minute. You know, so I think really just telling people what's going on. The way the Green Movement operates, operating here like that, tell people, "Hey, what's going on? Hey, look at this. This is what they're doing." You know, whenever, you know, I teach and I show my class some of the videos. I mean, totally, I teach in physical geography, right? Mountains and earthquakes. It has nothing to do with this, but I'll show them sometimes these videos, and they come up to me, they're like, why are they being beaten? What's going on? Just that kind of stuff. Just a little thing, like, "Hey, check this out." And then people come up with a different awareness. And then when they hear, "Oh, something's going on in Iran," they're like, "Yeah, you know, I saw this video." I mean, it sounds so corny, but I've seen it be amazing. I mean, I just think each one of us is the media, literally, and a leader of our own movements for this stuff. It's to me, I've never seen anything like this.
So do you have websites that have collections of links or pointers that the rest of us could use?
There's stuff out there. I don't have anything. I can email you, though, and send you some stuff, for sure. I think I saw you next.
But on that same point, I think it goes back to what Larry had brought up about a PR strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I think of kind of a grassroots movement and then trying to create greater visibility for what's going on, I think of the tactics that the Obama campaign used through its website, and so took everybody who was creating, you know, random, you know, acts of Obama support across the country and put it on their blog and highlighted and create whole sections of their website, like the Barnes for Obama movement. And the Access group could be building tools that would allow for a centralized place for appropriation and rebroadcast, that might keep the visibility higher for everybody that's both within the country and without.
Because we have to inform our leaders of human rights violations. We have to tell them, you know, because the pace of events on the ground is so much faster than the pace of events, you know, up there. It has to come from the bottom up now. This is showing me from the bottom up. CNN, they didn't care about Iran. And all of a sudden here they're like, CNN fail comes about. I mean, that's just an example. And other things start coming about where these people start paying attention just sheerly because people are saying, heads up. And I wouldn't have believed it. I was a total skeptic until I saw it. Total skeptic. I thought Twitter was the stupidest thing in the world on June 1st. I was, this is ridiculous. It's a waste of time. I worked there, we're going to try to put it, and I was like, this is stupid. Don't waste your time.
So just a layer of complexity on there. I mean, the Obama example is a great one. I think it has somewhat limited applicability here, where putting a banner on your website, if you're blogging in your real name or you associate your name with it, is a trip to prison, of course. So how do you keep this kind of energy going, where people are by necessity, anyone within the country is probably going to have to be anonymous? And I think that's somewhat uncharted territory in a way.
Yeah.
I think we're, in a way, turning the corner in this little magic era of digital activism online in repressive countries, and that this is really any mention of who you are and who your friends are is a roadmap for surveillance and arrest.
Totally.
And how that moves, you know, overt mention of these things overseas and how that impacts the actual how the message is received, I think it's very complicated.
I mean, one of the oddest examples to respond to that would be coming from 4chan and Anon, who had coordinated, you know, like protests against Scientology.
Yep.
You know, and that is a completely anonymous, disaggregated group that keeps on talking to each other and keeps on doing things.
We were all guy folks.
Yes.
Well, I was thinking anarchy when you said that, and it was, I mean, the interesting thing about 4chan and Anonymous was to the extent that they actually came together on something, and it's not a great example in that they were coming together to take someone else down in a way. And
well, that would be them.
I'm still waiting for them to come together to do something more kind of productive in a sense. But
an example with social media, like of causing problems, like you're talking about, when you come to Iran, and some people, when you come to Iran, they will sit you down and they'll say, log into your Facebook. You want to see your friends. Otherwise, you're going to jail. You're taking away right now. And so the advice is, if you're traveling and you're Iranian or diaspora traveling, delete your Facebook or, like, you know, hide it so that you don't have it. Then they'll Google search you and they'll try to find you and say, you do have a Facebook account. There's cash here, so log in. And you're sitting there with a bunch of big thugs with, you know, batons or whatever. And that's an example of social media is being taken into, you know, to the real world. You know, that's a new thing.
It's true. I mean, this like one password that can expose a whole network. It's frightening.
It's a lot easier just to confiscate your phone, arrest you, take your police station, take your phone. All your numbers are there. They don't ask you anything. It's complicated. Take a baton and tell you to log into Facebook. Yeah. Just take the phone. But they're not doing it. I mean, they're doing it to specific people that they're arresting, but they can take anybody. And they don't.
Yeah. A lot of the stuff that they do, this is extremely a show business based government. They will repress, and it's a nuclear issue. The enrich, we'll come to you. We'll do a little bit. We'll give you this to do, and then they come back. That's how they always. They've done it for 30 years, and it's like people just don't catch on, don't see the patterns. They don't look broadly and see the patterns of them coming forward, and then going back. They'll release a few people, and then they'll release 10 people, and imprison 200. But what makes the news is they release these people, not that they arrest 200. I mean, it's all show business. So it's so much of it. I mean,
coming back to Larry's point, maybe we should be learning the PR from them.
I think we have time for one more question. Given that the internet is about 40% of the population used,
but many of it's young people. Do you see trends of these people reaching out to older or younger generations to both teach them to use the internet and also to move the political aspects through the internet better?
Exactly. November, she keeps saying it for us, the November 4th protests, for the first time, you saw tons of high school and elementary kids coming out to the protests. For the first time, it's moving. And you saw a lot, if you look at the pictures, lots of old people coming. And you're hearing it, a lot of old people coming out saying, we made a mistake 30 years ago, we want to fix a mistake now. Yeah. It's really doing exactly what you're saying. It's amazing to watch.
We're also talking a lot about online technologies, but the truth is, like, a lot of these online, there are ways to transform these online technologies and take them offline. For example, taking videos off the internet and then, you know, putting them on a CD, sharing them with the relatives and their family. And so I mean, you know, from my discussions with people who are Iranian, this is definitely something that's happened. You know, they're very used to the kind of like this environment of severe restrictions. There's like a very strong like bootleg culture going on, and so like these protest videos are very much like kind of like treated as bootleg commodity. And in that way, it expands its demographic reach beyond the internet to reach other parts of the population.
You don't need to be on the internet to be touched by it, basically.
All right, I think that's it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us.